This is Lydia Jacobs, host of Aging Adventures. We keep everyone up to date on what's going on in the senior community in Lexington, conferences available, how to stay healthy. We talk to a wide range of people, professionals, individuals who are paving their own way in the aging world. Aging Adventures with host Lydia Jacobs on Fridays, 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock on 93.9 WLXU, a Lexington community radio. But in passing, we'll grow
older every day. Hi, everybody. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU, LPFM, Lexington Community Radio, coming into you sort of hot from the north side of Lexington, Kentucky, here on 6th Street, located in the beautiful 100-plus-year-old Johnson Elementary, recently known as the STEAM Academy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us. For the first hour, we heard from Alan Poe and Lee Majors, and with us in the studio for the next hour is local musician, activist extraordinaire DeBron Thomas.
I gotta follow Lee Majors.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Wait. Let's do it. They can build him stronger, faster, more handsome. No, that's impossible.
No way. Can't be.
Oh, that was our answering machine greeting when I was in college. Was the opening to $6 Million Man.
Nice.
And then we had like some message from a telemarketer say, and she forgot. She didn't realize she hadn't hung up, so she was saying, "Do you know what that answering machine message said? It said we can rebuild him." And we put it back on, and that became our answering machine greeting for a long time.
Nice.
I wish I still had that. We could use it in a promo. That's here on the radio.
It's super meta.
Yeah.
So DeBron, thank you for coming in and joining us today.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me.
On this sunny Friday.
When it's going to snow soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's true. A little bipolar Kentucky weather. It's strange.
Well, it's one thing I thought about when I first moved here. I think I moved here in 2009, and I remember, like, you know, there was the whole thing of, like, well, is global warming a thing? And I think less people were hip to it, you know, it the way that it is now. Mm-hmm. And I just told my friends, I said, you need to just come spend a day in Lexington, because there was one day during the winter in 2009 where, I kid you not, it rained, it was sunny, it was overcast, it hailed, and then it snowed.
Yeah.
All in the same day.
That sounds
fun. And then, was it 2 years ago, we had a day in January that was a negative 11?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then we had a day in January this year that was 75.
Yep.
But, you know, shall we digress? Because I want to ask you, DeBron, I know you're from California. What's the weather like where you're from? First of all, where are you from?
I'm from a city called Menlo Park, which is right in smack dab in the middle of the Bay Area. 30-45 minutes south of San Francisco, north of San Jose, and it's about that same distance to Oakland and Berkeley, right next to Palo Alto, where Stanford University is. Also the home of Facebook and Google. And, well, Google's in Mountain View, but Google started in Menlo Park. And also, fun fact, the death place of Vince Guaraldi.
Wow. Oh, the Charlie Brown music? Yeah.
But the weather there, to answer that part of the question, this time of year, it's probably about in the mid-50s. Usually, like, winter time usually probably doesn't get much colder than about maybe 40. Might hit 38 on a really crazy day. But, I mean, for the most part, it's usually pretty nice.
Pretty nice, but not as, like, ridiculous as L.A. weather.
Well, yeah, I know that just from talking to my mom that, like, the last year that they've had the whole issue with the drought, and now it's like raining uncontrollably. So, you know,
yeah, thanks, Nestle.
Yeah.
So DeBron, I wanted to ask you, kind of growing up in California, who are some of your influences? Because I know, you know, I know being close to San Francisco, you were exposed to that California funk, you know, funkadelic and
I saw the Grateful Dead when I was 4. They played a free concert in Palo Alto. And I don't know, you know, it's funny because, like, my whole, like, musical journey has been random in what I've been into. That's like, I've gotten into things and then gotten really obsessive about things. So, like, third grade, right, I was into Elvis and James Brown. And then as I got a little bit older, I kind of, you know, I mean, around the house, there was always gospel and funk and blues and jazz, you know, R&B. So like my house always had all kinds of music playing. But when I got into, you know, music really myself, I think probably when I was in, let's see, fifth grade, was when Supernatural came out, the Santana record that won all those Grammys. That was one thing that really, like, Santana was like my first guitar hero. And, you know, the Supernatural album caused me to go back and listen to all the other stuff. And as far as guitar heroes go, you know, obviously there's Hendrix and Eddie Hazel, who was the guitar player for the original lead guitar player for Funkadelic, Steve Ray Vaughan, Roy Buchanan. Really got into John Coltrane when I was in high school. You know, it's just one of the, you know, I think being in the Bay Area and learning like how many bands that I loved like were from the Bay Area was kind of a big thing, because once I got like formidable into like playing music, a lot of the bands that my dad would play with would have people who played with, like, you know, the Temptations and you know, Johnny Guitar Watson and all these other, you know, all these other people. So like Sly and the Family Stone was real big for me because, one, Sly Stone's the reason I even got into like wanting to do radio in general. But like, you know, that all of this like happened, and then it's like Hendrix came to Monterey, and I was like, oh man, I know Monterey, that's where the aquarium is with all the jellyfish, you know, like and it's, so it was just kind of really cool to see that all this history happened smack dab in the middle of where I grew up.
The Monterey Pop Festival, it's huge.
67,
it's true, it's where he lit his guitar on fire.
Yes,
played it with his teeth.
Well, the funny thing about that is so the Grateful Dead have gotten a really bad rap at two particular concerts. One being Woodstock, where nobody, there's recorded audio recordings, but nobody took any video of them playing at the at Woodstock. Right. Whoops. And then at the Monterey Pop Festival, they played in between The Who and Jimi Hendrix. The whole thing between, you know, Pete Townsend and Jimi Hendrix was who was going to go first. So The Who went first. So then Jimmy's like, oh, well, then I got to step my game up. So the Grateful Dead were in between them.
Wow.
You know, people remember the fact that Keith Moon tore his drum, you know, his drums up, and, you know, Pete Townsend did the whole thing that he did with his guitar. And then on the flip side, Hendrix burned his. It's like, well, so did you remember the Grateful Dead? Yeah, man, they, you know.
Yeah, and that was this really pivotal moment in Hendrix's life, too, where he had finally gone to England and started to get some notoriety and enough to come back and play a huge festival here in the States. And that, I think that burning of the guitar is pretty symbolic of like, hey, I'm home.
It's so funny to me because I was having this conversation with my guitar teacher yesterday, actually. You know, as a black guitar player, I get pigeonholed into this, like, oh man, you sound like, you know, and if I tell somebody that I play guitar, 9 times out of 10, the first thing is, oh, so you play blues? And I mean, well, yes, I would say that blues is a basis of the music that
I play. That's a basis of everything, so technically.
Right, but it's not all that I do. And I think that, you know, Hendrix, like, my guitar teacher and I were talking about, like, how Hendrix, like, changed the entire shape of that particular portion of music. And every guitar player, whether they are, have a direct influence to him or not, owes him credit for the groundbreaking work that he did. But of course, because he's a person of color, you know, they're not going to let you have everything, you know? And I just, it blows my mind. Like when I, like, not to talk down about people, but it's crazy to me when like people like Robin Trower get praised for what they did. I'm like, but that dude literally just took what Hendrix did and didn't do anything like relatively.
No Electric Ladyland.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and like I remember as a kid, like people would talk about like, oh, well, you got to get into Eric Clapton. And so that's a funny thing to me because growing up, the Eric Clapton that I grew up listening to was like In My Father's Eyes and, you know, Tears from Heaven. So like I didn't know that he was like a guitar. And, like,
the whole Cream, Derek and the Dominoes side.
And so once I understood about that, people would tell me like, oh, yeah, so, you know, who's better, you know, Hendrix or Clapton? And I was just like, it's not a competition, first of all, but it's really not a competition.
But I think even Clapton would admit, you know, when Hendrix first showed up in England, because Hendrix came, you know, by the bassist from the Animals, Eric Burton and the Animals, his girlfriend saw Hendrix play at Cafe Wa in New York and was like, you got to come see this guy. And then basically pawned their amps and flew him to England to perform and to start playing. And I think on like the fourth or fifth night he was there, he ended up getting on stage with Clapton. And they kind of had this duel back and forth. And
well, Clapton walked off stage.
Yeah.
There's that story that he went back into the dressing room and had himself like a meditation session that he just sat there looking at the wall for like an hour.
My life is a lie.
Oh, no. What have I done?
What have I done?
My favorite Hendrix story is that he opened for the Monkees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love that story. It's because there were like little kids running out of the arena going, Mommy, Daddy, there's a fire on stage. Call the fire department.
You know, the guitar that he played at Woodstock, the White Strat, actually belonged to Keith Richards, and Keith Richards' girlfriend, Linda Keith, who was like the conduit of making all this stuff happen, right? She gave that guitar to him, and, you know, it was like, well, you got to give it back to Keith at some point.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, Hendrix died like maybe like nine, 10 months after Woodstock, so like never got it back.
Yeah, you think he's like wondering where that guitar is?
Well, I mean, the flip side of that too is like, well, now it's part of this iconic performance. Mm. So like, it's not like Keith Richards can be like, "Can I get that?
Where's
guitar
me guitar?"
Yeah, like nothing's sitting in a museum somewhere.
Yeah. He would just put it in a case somewhere. You can't play that now.
It's legendary.
Just sit on a shelf somewhere. Let it sit on a shelf where people can see it.
Right. Yeah.
So DeBron. Is it true your cousin is Ray Parker Jr., right?
We are related. He is let me see if I can remember this right. So he is my Aunt Julia's grandson, I think, maybe. I'm not entirely sure how it works out, but my Aunt Julia is my grandmother's, on my dad's side, my grandmother's sister. It's one of those things that my dad told me when I was a kid, and I was like, oh, Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters theme.
And then it's like I go through and I listen to all these funk records, and it's just like Ray Parker Jr. on guitar. Ray Parker Jr. co-wrote this song. And I'm like, there you go.
Yeah, he's like the Harry Nilsson of funk. You know, like he wrote all those songs, but nobody knows that. Everybody just knows the Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Ghostbusters theme.
I feel like him and Bobby McFerrin could be like, you know. Like there's this record that Bobby McFerrin did with Chick Corea where they did nothing but Mozart covers.
What?
And like the stuff, it's incredible. And it's like, wow, this is amazing. This is the most, like, so, this is like some of the craziest things I've ever heard. But Don't Worry, Be Happy is going to be the song everybody's going to know you for.
Of course. Yeah. So is your family, you said your father also plays.
Yeah, he's a singer.
So is your family super musically oriented? Like, when did you start playing guitar? Was that a huge part of kind of your education growing up?
So music was like a big part of just everything growing up. One of my parents' really good friends was this guy named Peter Chaplin, and his brother was Blondie Chaplin, who played with the Rolling Stones and the Beach Boys. He sang Sail on Sailor. And so, like, growing up, like, I always kind of, like, had different people, like, sneaking music to me here and there. And my Uncle Steve, who's my mom's brother, he was, like, super into, like, blues and jazz and always had, like, you know, different records and stuff like that playing. But I really didn't get into music until I was about maybe like 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. And I got my first guitar at 13. My dad, you know, he's a singer. And so like he was all about it. And like the thing was, it's like, so if we buy this for you, like, you know, you have to actually practice and learn how to play.
No, is this something you asked for or was something that was given to you?
It was something that I asked for. And you know, it's funny because thinking back on it now, I wanted to start playing guitar when I was 12, but I thought, oh man, if I start playing, like all my friends were playing, and I was just like, oh, well then I'm just going to be seen as like a poser, you know? And so I'm like, now I'm thinking like at 28 years old, I'm like, man, I could have had like one more year of like messing around before I actually like tried to pick it up. But I met my guitar teacher in February of 2004, and his name is Garrick Davis, and we had an instant connection, and like everything just kind of blew up from there. It was really, I think a big part of it was at that particular point in my life, I was undergoing this whole like psychological thing where, you know, white kids called me Oreo and black kids called me whitewashed. And I was just like, I don't understand any of this. Why are you saying this to me? Mm-hmm. And then having a guitar teacher who was black who was also into Hendrix, kind of just made me feel like, okay, so there's something wrong with these people, not me.
Right.
And then, you know, getting into Sly and the Family Stone and Funkadelic and, you know, the Band of Gypsies specifically with Hendrix stuff, like, it was all life-changing for me, and it just kind of, you know, gave me the push that I needed, I think, to really care more about working on myself and not necessarily what other people thought.
Yeah, that kind of seems to be, I was thinking about it the other day, one of the toughest things about being a kid is realizing that, yes, everybody else but you can be wrong about something. And that's often the case because kids are little monsters and they're just let loose and running around. And so what was it that made you want a guitar? Was it a particular person or album or... what happened to you at 12 that said, I need to pick this up?
Well, so my dad wanted me to play keyboards, and I was just like, you know, I want to be Jimi Hendrix. But I remember when I was in seventh grade, like the turning moment for me, like when I was 12, I like kind of wanted to play guitar because I thought it would be really cool and really fun to do. And I wanted to kind of like play some Santana type stuff, right? But I remember seeing a friend of mine play Jimi Hendrix's version of All Along the Watchtower at the school talent show. And I just remember thinking, I was like, wow, this is incredible. And my friend Andrew Altoff at the time was like, oh, well, you should listen to the actual version. And I was just like, oh my God.
This the is Dylan version or that?
No, the Hendrix version. And I was just like, oh my God. So then like that next weekend I went out and got a, this album called Experience Hendrix. And it was just like a greatest hits.
Yeah.
And I was listening to it in my room. And this was the first CD that I ever bought where I wasn't sure how my mom was going to react. So I'm like sitting in my room and the, you know, the speaker's playing. And I think like Crosstown Traffic was playing. And my mom walked around the corner and I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And she walks by my door and then turns around and pokes her head in. And she's like, what are you doing? I was like, I said, I'm just listening to music. She's like, nobody listens to Jimi Hendrix that low. Turn it up.
You're like,
there you go.
I love my mom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Well, just in case you're joining us, we are talking with DeBron Thomas, and you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU. So, DeBron, can I ask you, what brought you to Kentucky, and... Once you got here, what were you surprised by as far as the musical scene here and kind of our musical history compared to California?
Well, I was packaged up in a box and went was on a UPS truck. it was a crazy ride. I originally came out here to go to school. I attended the University of Kentucky. My mom is actually from Adair County, so... As a kid, I spent a lot of my summers here in Kentucky, not in Lexington, but in Adair County, Columbia area, and Louisville too. And so, like, Kentucky has always been a place that I've had a special affinity for because that's where my mom grew up. It's where a lot of my family was from. And
you say Louisville.
Yes.
So, yeah, you're a Kentuckian.
It's weird. My mom says Louisville. And I'm like, you're from here. And, you know, you know. But anyways, yeah, I've always loved Kentucky. And when I came here to Lexington, I was kind of surprised at, honestly, how... I don't want to say that I had like preconceived notions of Lexington because I really
oh go didn't. Ahead everybody does
yeah I did too
but okay. But like I think I was just surprised at like the quality of bands that were doing original music because you know where I'm from like the Bay Area is full of super talented people but the Bay Area is really spread out and like while yeah you might have some people that like you know played with everybody you know you're only going to run into them maybe at a blues jam or unless you like play a gig with them right here in Lexington like there are some of the most amazing musicians I've ever seen in my life and one of them lives right down the street from me you know what yeah, I mean right. Like and so I think the biggest thing was just seeing just how much great music there is in the city. You know, now getting people to come out to shows is an entirely different beast. And I think that that's like, you know, that's just like a whole other, you know, that's a whole other conquest to try to make. But I think from an artistic standpoint, it's really easy to continue to be creative because there are so many other creative people that we can all push each other.
It's true.
It's
tangible.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I actually ended up getting into the music scene. I played in a cover band, And then that band splintered off into another band. And then after that band was done, I decided that I wanted to do something that was more like, I wanted to do more of a trio type, like rock blues type thing. Mm-hmm. I really was in this vein where I was just like, all right, I want to play a lot of like Hendrix, and I want to play a lot of like Stevie Ray Vaughan and some Ray Charles and stuff like that, but just do like stripped down like soul covers. Mm-hmm. And so I started this band with Smith Donaldson and Daniel Moeller. Smith is like one of the most, you know, revered bass players in Lexington. Mm. Because he plays with everybody.
And it's officially the DeBron Thomas Trio.
Yeah. Well, so yeah. And so we started that band. It was originally called the Memory Lane Gang. And then people told me that the band name was terrible. And Smith and Daniel got together. Daniel used to play with the other brothers and the Ravenna Colt and so many other great bands in Lexington. And they got together, and I they were like, we need to be doing DeBron's original stuff. Mm. And I would just kind of, it was one of those things where I just kind of would sneak in some songs I wrote, and I was like, hey, check this out. Like, this would be fun to play. And then it just became the DeBron Thomas Trio, which is like still a very strange thing. But I will say that this has been a really incredible ride. Mm-hmm. There have been a lot of highs, and then 2 years ago, there was a really bad low, but it's been, you know, it's been really good.
Yeah, and you released your album, All My Colors Are Blind, first full length. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about that and kind of the recording process and how long it took you to put together?
Too long. Well, so that record was recorded with Dwayne Lundy at Shangri-La Productions.
Here in Lexington.
Here in Lexington. And so at the time I had... when we had kind of decided to start talking about, recording a record, a lot of my friends had, you know, suggested it. And so I met with Dwayne one time, and he showed me the studio, and it was really cool. But really where he had me was, he's like, yeah, you know, I learned how to mic drums from Eddie Kramer. And I was just like, wait, what? Who? You know, Eddie Kramer, who famously recorded like all of Hendrix's stuff. Yeah. And I was like, oh, so can we get like stereo phasing on every song then? Is that, I met with Dwayne, and we decided to do the record. And over the course of kind of the recording process, what ended up happening is like all these songs, they all kind of were bookmarks for a particular point in my life. And I had gotten out of a relationship in 2012, and my Uncle Steve passed away like a week after this happened. So like my whole life just kind of like was a spiral for a minute. And so the record was nice to be able to put a bookend on all of that. All the songs are about just different things that happened to me over the course of like 3 and 4 years. And I thought I made it, and it was great. And then the record came out in October of 2015. And then November 12th, 2015, I broke my pinky on my right hand. Mm. And was unable to play music for 8 months. That was interesting because like, the show that I had played, I only had one show on the books at that particular point in time, and it was opening for Nick West at the Lyric Theater. Mm. And she's an incredible bass player, but the thing for me was that John Blackwell was playing drums with her, and John Blackwell was the drummer from the New Power Generation. Mm-hmm. And oh my goodness, it was crazy. And I played this show with a broken finger. I had was on so much ibuprofen, but...
Now, are you right-handed or left-handed?
I'm right-handed. Okay. So it's my picking hand.
Right.
But, you know, one of the things that my doctor said is, like, essentially, you know, the muscle that makes your hand move, you know, where you're allowing to move your fingers, it's one muscle that fans out into your hand. So if one muscle is having to, you know, is not working correctly, the rest of your hand has to overcompensate. And that was, I think, the hardest part for me was, after having surgery and recovering, was trying to sit and play guitar and do different picking exercises that I've been able to do since I was like 13, 14, that I was unable to do. It's just one of those things where you get a roadblock, but you have to continue to push forward, and you have to, you know, keep chucking away and keep chipping away.
Yeah. Do you feel like that injury, would spark maybe a great song on the next album? Or did you feel like you learned something about guitar or yourself while having to kind of sit idle for that long?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This is something I don't really talk about very much, but I actually decided to quit drinking in 2015. I played a show New Year's Eve, and that was the last night that I had a drink, and I've been sober for 2 years. And it started at something that I was like, well, you know, let me just go 30 days and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And then 30 days turned into 3 months, and then 3 months turns into 6 months, and then I'm like, well, I might as well just keep going. And so when I broke my finger, it was one thing that just made everything came full circle, mm-hmm. and I felt like it was God telling me, hey, like, if you can do this, you're going to be able to handle this later on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, playing music is a big part of my livelihood. It's one of the ways I help pay my bills. Mm-hmm. My two jobs alone do not, you know, allow me to pay my rent on time and to, you know, pay my whatever other bills that I have. So for me, this whole experience has been great because I feel like I have a much better understanding of where I am as a person. Mm-hmm. But also, like, anytime I pick up the guitar now, I approach it from the standpoint of, you might not ever be able to play this again. You mm-hmm. might never be able to do this again. So you have to appreciate every single mm-hmm. moment of it. And so that's the biggest change, if anything. It might not necessarily be a song, but it's definitely the way that I approach the guitar now.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. And that's great to hear. And I'm glad your finger's back. Can I ask you a little bit about your other jobs? One, you work at WUKY, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I do. You host a show over there as well.
I host the Crunkadelic Funk Show, which airs Saturday nights at 9 on 91.3 WUKY. I also do a feature on local musicians that airs on Monday called Local Music Mondays.
Mm-hmm. And people can access those online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're all available at the WUKY.org. And I worked on this thing with Frank X. Walker in 2012 called The Unghosting of Medgar Evers, mm-hmm. which was basically like kind of like a soundscape show that was based on poetry of a book of poetry that he had written from the different people. It was coming from the viewpoints of different people in the life of civil rights leader Medgar Evers. Mm-hmm. And so that was really, really cool. And then that book went on to win an NAACP Image Award. I didn't get anything, but, you know, hey, yeah. Frank was the one that did the work to put all that together. So, you know, but I just worked on the radio version of it, and it was, it's something that's actually being used as teaching material in some classes now. Wow. So
it's awesome. Yeah, it's very cool. Mm-hmm. Well, DeBron, maybe we should take a quick break, and would you mind playing a song for us?
Sure.
If you're feeling it.
Yeah, I could do that.
Cool. So maybe we'll take a quick break here, maybe cut to a spot or so, but nonetheless, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios. We're here with DeBron Thomas, and we'll be right back here in just a few seconds.
Lexington Community Radio's programming is brought to you by Answer One. Operating for over 20 years, Answer One specializes as a 24/7 telephone answering service, as well as voicemail, fax, order processing, and message delivery services to medical and doctor's offices, small businesses, startup companies, and government agencies. To learn more, you can visit their website at www.answerone.biz or call 859-269-3482. Lexington Community Radio thanks Answer One for supporting true community radio.
Cornbread every day.
Hey there, heat up those skillets. This is Chris Michael,
Weta Michael,
and Rona Roberts,
your co-hosts for Hot Water Cornbread Kentucky Food Radio, happening every Tuesday at noon Eastern Time on WLXU 93.9 LPFM here at Lexington Community Radio.
We start each show with a look back at foods, drinks, and recipes we enjoyed the week before. Think bourbon, sorghum, and corn with oysters and the occasional lemon squeezed in.
Our guests include poets, chefs, farmers, cooks, artists, historians, professors, and gardeners. Listen in as we talk about our unique food economy, history, and culture. If you miss our live broadcast on Tuesday at noon, catch the rebroadcast of Hot Water Cornbread every week on 93.9 FM on Wednesdays at 11 and Saturdays at 7 p.m. We'll see you at the table.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU. Coming to you live from the north side of Lexington. We're here in the studio with DeBron Thomas, and he's going to play a little music for us. DeBron, what you got lined up?
So I was thinking about just what you said about, you know, when we were talking about me coming back from the injury, and there was a song that I wrote. One of the things that I learned is, you know, just from not being able to do something that you feel like you're put on the earth to do, makes you reevaluate your entire life. And so there was somebody that I really cared about, and I, you know, thought about asking them out and telling them how I felt. And, mm-hmm. you know, while this particular song worked for a short period of time, I have a really good relationship with this person now. We're not together, obviously, but, you know, it, for me, the song stands more for not, you know, not, hiding behind things and taking a chance on your, you know, not only your, you know, yourself, but on other people. So this song is called Risk.
Thank you very much, DeBron. That was a beautiful song. So, DeBron, in addition to playing music, you are also an activist.
I think that I do not deserve the term activist. There are people, a lot of people in town.
You engage in action.
Yeah, I use the term community. Or I use the term organizer.
Okay.
Because I there are a lot of people in this city that are doing a lot of really great work. Mm. And I do not deserve the term. I don't believe I deserve the term activist. But yes, I would consider myself an organizer.
Totally. I understand that. That's pretty fair. And so you work with the Take Back Cheapside movement. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to people that don't know kind of what is Take Back Cheapside?
So Cheapside Park is a portion it's the main square downtown on over by Short Street and Main mm-hmm. Street over there by the pavilion where the old courthouse is. And that at one point in time was the second home to the second largest slave trade auction block in the country. And it was right here in Lexington. And so thousands upon thousands of people were bought, sold, and ripped away from their families. And it was also used as a place where people were publicly whipped and beaten in front of the courthouse. But that was, you know, in the early, about the turn of the century. But anyways, so in that space, there is really, right now, there is no recognition of what it was as a space. Mm-hmm. And there are two statues, one of John C. Breckinridge and the other one of John Hunt Morgan, which are two members of the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. John C. Breckinridge's statue was erected in 1887 by the state, actually. Mm-hmm. And the other statue was put up in 1911 by the Daughters of the Confederacy. And it was part of this whole Reconstruction movement, you know, after mm-hmm. the Civil War.
Yeah.
And those statues were basically placed there, I mean, of slave owners. You know, John C. Breckinridge is the only senator to be expelled mm-hmm. from the Senate.
Yeah.
And John Hunt Morgan, you know, led a command of people and ended up actually fleeing the Confederacy, going mm-hmm. to Canada, yeah. I believe.
That's where he died, right?
Yeah, I think so. And anyways, you know, you have these statues of these two people who were who owned slaves, fought to keep slavery. You know, you can sit there and say that Civil War was about states' rights, but a yeah. big chunk of it was the economy of slavery.
No, for sure.
And so having those statues there is kind of a slap in the face to, you know, people, to all people who have fought for equality in this country. And it's the equivalent of having, you know, statues of SS soldiers in Auschwitz. So anyways, we Take Back Cheapside is a coalition of a couple of different, of many different groups here in Lexington who want equality and want to see, you know, that space be used as a place that everyone can go to. So we essentially have a 3-point plan. One is to remove the statues. There was a plaque that was brought up, put up in 2001 by the Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity. Mm-hmm. In 2015, that plaque was vandalized. It was the only thing that actually said any history mm-hmm. of, you know, Cheapside.
I remember
as a slave,
that. It was
slave
on the back
market.
Side of the mm-hmm. courthouse. Yeah.
Yeah. In 2015, it was vandalized and it was recast, and it's sitting in a warehouse on Liberty Road right now, but it's not slated to be brought back until the finishing of the courthouse, mm-hmm. which isn't supposed to be scheduled for 2018. Yeah. So we want the plaque brought back. And then the third point is to open up dialogue on how we can use this space as a place where everyone feels comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, glorifying people like that look, I will be completely honest. I'm a history buff, so I can even as a person of color, I can look at things from the Confederacy and appreciate them from a standpoint of history. Like, yes, it happened. It's not something that we can hide from. It's not something that needs to be buried away so that nobody sees it. But those statues don't need to be in a place where people were bought and sold, and they were essentially put there for the same reason that the Confederate flag was raised in the 50s, was as another of one of many messages of people of color to stay in their place.
Mm-hmm.
So we're working we're working to get these statues removed, moved to another, another more appropriate place, mm-hmm. and have the plaque brought back, and, you know, hopefully at some point in time we can get these you know, make this space inclusive for all people.
That's great. And I think also giving proper historical context to what has happened in the past. And I'm curious kind of why was the plaque not put back up after it was taken down during the construction?
It was we have talked with the mayor. But essentially the reasoning behind it was so that it wasn't damaged, you know, you can still have the words put up there on a piece of paper on a cardboard thing. Yeah. I mean, if Morgan's statue can be boxed up in plywood, why not, you know, just print what the plaque said and at least have it there, because without it, those statues are even more offensive.
Yeah, or the wrap around center point, something like that. Something that at least gives somewhat of historical context.
Am I crazy, or does that change? Because it seems like sometimes I drive by there and there's different pictures.
I'm not sure.
But, you know, it's funny, speaking of just racist statues, though. Like, so earlier this week, I went to the Capitol, and, you know, there is the statue of Jefferson Davis that's in the rotunda. Yeah. And I understand that's been a choice of, you know, point of controversy for a lot of different reasons. But for me, the point that I apparently missed was I took a picture of this. There is a plaque on the statue that says Jefferson Davis, born Fairview, Kentucky, June 3rd, 1808, died December 6th, 1889, only president of the Confederacy. And then right underneath it, it says patriot, hero, statesman. Now, there's two things wrong. Apparently, you know, because last I checked, if you go against the country, they call you, treason. They say it's treason, right? So that's like the opposite of patriot, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like heroes, and I don't particularly, I mean, you know, this is just one man's opinion. I understand that, you know, the Jefferson Davis has a very unique history as to how he got into because he didn't actually want to be president of the Confederacy. He was kind of dragged into it. But still, though, this was a whole thing that wanted to subjugate the use of people who weren't even treated as human, you know, and you're going to sit there and call him a hero. Yeah. And that's in the state capitol building. That's something that needs to change as well.
I agree. And, you know, I want to ask kind of what is it going to take for us to get rid of those statues? And in the work of Take Back Cheapside, you know, what's holding us back from doing it tomorrow?
So, essentially, what has to happen is those statues are controlled by the Kentucky Military and Heritage Council. The city is getting tax credits for the reconstruct or the renovation of the courthouse. Reconstruction, that would have been an iconic pun. But for for the renovation of the courthouse. And so basically what has to happen is the city has to, well, nothing can go in because of, let me back up. So nothing can go into that space that's new for 5 years, because that's how the way the tax credits work. But those statues can be moved. What has to happen is, one, we have to find a place to put them, and that has to be approved by the place that we would recommend them to go. Then we would have to go to the Kentucky Military and Heritage Council and tell them, hey, like, we want to move these statues. They give the okay. Then it comes back to the city council votes on it, and that's how we get those statues moved. But there's a lot of leg room and legwork that has to happen in between. One of the most offensive things to me is just how many people I talk to about Cheapside that don't know that space, that go down to Thursday Night Live or go down there on the weekend and have a party and have a good time. That's, you know, that's all well and dandy, but like, the fact that people live in the city and don't know that this exists is kind of a problem.
Yeah, I didn't know till like 4 or 5 years ago. If somebody wants to get involved, how do they, for either way, or maybe, hey, somebody will say, hey, I'll take the statues and put them in my backyard.
I got a spot on the Kentucky River.
Anywhere. How can they get in touch with you guys, get involved?
We have a website. It's takebackcheapside.com. And you know, you can click the contact link on there. We're also on Facebook, but you have to be part of the cool club to get there. So I would say that the best way would be to go to takebackcheapside.com.
Okay, cool.
That's great. And yeah, I think educating people about our city and our history is the only way that we don't repeat the same mistakes that we have made.
Yeah,
and to pay respects, you know.
I mean, it's funny to me that when you asked me earlier what was one of the first things that I noticed when I moved here, and I didn't really answer it because I kind of got off tangent, but really one of the first things that I noticed was the word tradition gets thrown around here a lot.
Yeah.
But it's not the traditions of anybody that looks like me. Like, with everything that's going on this side of town, you know, it's amazing to me how people want to, you know, say, hey, well, we have to preserve this house because this person lived here and it can be turned into a museum. But an entire neighborhood that was started by people of color, freed slaves, you know, the entire North, this is one thing another fascinating thing I learned about Lexington is the entire North part of the city for the most part, was founded by freed slaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I learned yesterday that the reason why our blocks are so long is mm-hmm. because when the hemp industry was so popular here, they needed enough length to be able to twist the rope. And so I guess that was why we have long blocks. Anyway, but yeah, I agree. And the way that our history was set up too is a lot of neighborhoods, you know, you had the plantation, and you had the master's house facing another master's house, and then all of the slave houses on the exact opposite side of that master's house. Mm-hmm. And you can see that if you just walk up limestone, you can see that's how it's laid out. And so, yeah, it's totally true. And, you know, where are the historical markers that tell us that? Like, besides, we just hear it through anecdotes or maybe, you know, randomly read something, something online. But
I mean, like the newer courthouse that's on limestone, was built by Verner Woodson Tandy, who was the first African-American architect in the state of New York. He's from Lexington. Mm-hmm. You know, he built that, and he also built Madam C.J. Walker's house. You know, it's kind of like... But going as far as oppression goes, you know, a lot of these things are just used to distract. And I'd like to read a poem, if I may.
Please, yeah. Maybe we'll close out with this.
Okay, well, so I this poem was written in 1968 by Gil Scott-Heron. Wow. And the first time I heard it, I just couldn't stop laughing because I was like, this still happens. So this poem is called Whitey on the Moon.
Ah, yes, know it well.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the Moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the Moon. I can't pay no doctor bill, but Whitey's on the Moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the Moon. The man just upped my rent last night, 'cause Whitey's on the Moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the Moon. I wonder why he's upping me, 'cause Whitey's on the Moon. I was already paying him 50 a week with Whitey on the Moon. Taxes taking my whole damn check. Junkies making me a nervous wreck. The price of food is going up, and if all it wasn't enough, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the Moon. Her face and arms began to swell, but Whitey's on the Moon. What was all that money I made last year for Whitey on the Moon? How come there ain't no money here? Whitey's on the Moon. You know, I just about done had my fill of Whitey on the Moon. I think I'll send these doctor bills, airmail special, to Whitey on the Moon.
That's great. Classic poem.
I mean, it's great because it's like, I'm broke, but yet, I mean, even look at it with our healthcare system right now. That's a whole other conversation. But mm-hmm. I'm just saying, like, this still happens. And it's amazing to me that songs, poetry, you know, and art that was made, you know, 50 years ago, is still extremely relevant in 2017.
Right.
Think about it, though. It's not, are the songs and stuff really that good? I mean, they are, but what is that really saying? Mm. That we can still relate to these problems because they're still happening today.
That's true. And, you know, with movements like Take Back Cheapside and Surge and, you know, I think slowly it's really something that can only get better one-on-one and calling people out for being bigots, calling people out for, you know, being unjust.
The most important thing is that this is not just a, you know, it's not just a poor issue. It's not just a black issue. It's not a white issue. It's a issue of human decency.
It's true.
And if we are going to rise up above the oppression and move forward and make actual progress, mm-hmm. it's going to take every single person willing to fight. And that might not be people that all look the same.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the great part about it. That's the great part of America. You know, people want to say make America great again. Well, America has been okay. Mm-hmm. If you really want to make America great again, let's make it equal for all people.
Yeah, let's celebrate our differences.
Yes.
Well, DeBron, thank you so much for coming in. It was great to talk with you here and hear some music from you and learn more about Take Back Cheapside.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime.
You know, the first time I was on the radio was with Chuck Clenny.
Really? That's true. Shout out to WRFL.
Yeah.
Just celebrated its 29th anniversary.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's amazing.
And if you missed any portion of the show, we're on LexingtonCommunityRadio.org. We're on iTunes. We're on SoundCloud. We're on tomorrow. You can't miss us.
Yeah, we'll be on everywhere tomorrow at 11 a.m. if you want to check out the show. Thanks for listening, and Rice for Rooney University is up next. Have a great weekend, and we'll catch you next week.